Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Artificial intelligence started as the stuff of science fiction, but like it or not, it's actually here and being adopted by business and industry at a rapid clip. But like any new technology, some are wary, and in this case, they should be. While artificial intelligence, or AI, holds great potential for improving our lives, there are also risks, and many in industry have called for the establishment of best practices and the promotion of responsible AI. Among them is Chief Operations and Technology Officer at the Bank of America, Kathy Bessant. Her work at the bank and concerns about the dangers and ethical challenges presented by artificial intelligence prompted her to approach Harvard University to create the Council on the Responsible Use of Artificial Intelligence. Kathy Bessant is with us for the hour to help us understand and explore this new world for many, including me. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you for being here. And we're also joined by Dan Schrag. He is the co-director of the Science, Technology, and Public Policy Program at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School. The Belfer Center helped establish the Council on the Responsible Use of AI. He also was a member of President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Dan Schrag joins us, I presume, from Massachusetts. Is that right?
That's right. I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Okay, via Skype. Welcome to the program, Dan. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Before we talk about artificial intelligence, Kathy, I know that you, as a former member of the UNC Charlotte Board of Trustees, wanted to say something about the tragic loss of life at that university.
Well, yeah, thank you, Mike. As a Charlottean, it's all we're talking about, all we're focused on, and I think actually germane to the topic we're talking about today. You know, I've got a 19-year-old and a 23-year-old.
Wow.
And so I'm heartbroken. I'm the daughter of a school teacher, 40-year high school teacher, who taught us all that schools were places of safe learning. You know, that's horrifying. It goes against everything I grew up with. And I think as a citizen, as a general citizen, as a former UNC Charlotte trustee, I'm completely and totally, like everybody else, outraged. And so while my heart hurts, my head goes so quickly to, what are we going to do to stop the madness? What are we going to do to stop the madness? We're getting better at healing. We're getting better at detecting and responding in the moment. It's why things yet on this week were not worse. Mm-hmm. But what are we doing about prevention? And I actually think there's something in this dialogue around data and computing power, without seeming insensitive, that can contribute and should contribute responsibly to the solution.
How so?
Well, understanding who might be likely to enter a church or a college campus.
Are you talking about profiling?
No.
Using data already on hand?
No, using data the way people use it today. I know where my kids are.
Okay.
I know what they've purchased. You know, it's hard for me to speculate on what would be helpful, but I do think that prevention is part of is heavily influenced by our ability to predict. And that's what the use of data and compute power, the science of artificial intelligence, is all about.
Bank of America is an international organization. It may be headquartered here, but it's all over the world. And I know that you probably talk to business leaders from all over the world at some point in your yearly trek around the bank. What are other people in other countries saying about this kind of violence in the United States? Anything particular?
Most of the dialogue that I hear outside of the United States has to do with the proliferation, the surprising to others, to other countries, proliferation of guns. So if I'm in the UK, they'll say, you know, it's only been in the last 20 years that our policemen mm-hmm. carry guns. And so most of the international dialogue is about the weapons discussion. Increasingly, there's an international dialogue around mental health, and I think that that's very constructive and very important to prevention and also to healing and recovery. But those are probably the two principal topics.
Mm. If artificial intelligence could be used to perhaps prevent or to identify possible perpetrators of this kind of violence and intercede before they do something that they'll regret the rest of their lives. Could it also be used to understand better what is leading people to think it's okay to have an arsenal of weaponry in their apartment that they then turn on their fellow human beings?
Yes, absolutely. There is so much, and in fact, today we do it in hindsight. What's the first thing we do? We go to a trespasser's or a criminal's social media to try to understand what was the motivation. There would be a different power in understanding that motivation at scale before the transgression. I hate the word transgression. It sounds so clinical, and I'm sorry about that. It's sort of how I get through this discussion without crying, literally. But data could be very powerful here. Imagine if we wanted to understand who was buying weaponry, and a seller could understand immediately who might be standing in front of them.
This is one of the things we're going to talk about as we go through the program, because everything you're talking about, the ability of computers to crunch data and identify certain patterns and spit out results that maybe we as human beings can benefit from, also deals with privacy issues. If you start collecting all this data and looking at innocent people making innocent transactions and inaccurately ascribe to those innocent transactions something that you see as nefarious, that could be a major problem.
It's exactly why the concept of responsible artificial intelligence is so important. The great power of data and computers should be for the forces of good, should be for the benefit of society. But it doesn't take long to realize that infrastructure, that our ethical framework, our legal framework, our privacy framework are behind the capabilities of the technology, that people have, in some cases, most cases, willingly given away more data than they ever understood would be used and before they even understood how it would be.
Right.
Used. If I knew that using a pizza delivery application would give somebody the ability to track what was happening at my house, probably be a little more careful about my pizza delivery strategy. And I don't mean to make light of it, but this issue of the power of artificial intelligence for good must be captured. We've got to use it. The question is how to make sure that that use gets all the benefit without all the risk.
Dan Schrag up in Massachusetts, most of us know about artificial intelligence through science fiction novels and science fiction movies and television shows where usually artificial intelligence is cast in the role of the villain. And perhaps there is a great reason for that, it seems to me, like HAL, the computer in 2001, A Space Odyssey, simply would not respond to the commands of the human being and didn't care. When you talk about the promises and challenges of artificial intelligence, what are you talking about? What exactly is artificial intelligence?
Well, this gets into a little bit of a technical dive, which we may not want to go too deep. But true artificial intelligence is actually not what we're talking about when computer scientists talk about actual artificial intelligence. The way artificial intelligence is being used now by a broad community and the way we've been talking about it really is a broad array of technologies that includes what is called machine learning. That is algorithms that can learn from data and from the world and actually come up with their own rules. A nice example of this was, for example, the team at Google that created a set of algorithms that played the game Go, and with no teaching, no training, over a period of relatively short time, the machine essentially learned the game, taught itself the game, and then beat the world's best Go players. And that was an incredible demonstration, I think, of what this technology can do. But it's really a whole set of technologies, including what we might call data science and also machine learning.
Is machine learning essentially the same thing as artificial intelligence, or is it a subset?
So I think to a computer scientist, they would say there's a big distinction. But I think for us, we can think of machine learning as a step on the way to true artificial intelligence. Okay. That is, machines that think and are able to do that. We may be decades away still from true artificial intelligence, but what we call AI in terms of technology, as I said, it's a broad suite of technologies, but includes things. Machine learning is certainly at the core of it.
So if machines are learning, or if algorithms allow computer programs to make decisions, quite often when human beings make decisions, we disagree with those decisions. What happens when a human being disagrees with the decision being made by a computer or a machine? In science fiction, they would say we lose. Is that what you're trying to guard against? Is that one of the things that you're addressing or concerned about at all?
Well, I think you've just shown both sides. That example is both sides of the issue, mm-hmm. because sometimes the human being is wrong. Sometimes hiring decisions are biased. Sometimes lending decisions can be biased. And in those cases, great use of artificial intelligence can improve on human decision making. But at the same time, the algorithms that create the learnings can in fact be create the opportunity for the problems with human decision making to be manifested at scale. So if we want hiring to be more diverse, which certainly at Bank of America we do, if we build a model that only relies on who we've hired in the past, all we're doing is perpetuating a system that we want to be more diverse. So how that model is created is very important to whether that is whether the use in layman's terms is beneficial or perpetuates the fallibility of humans. There's a lot more learning to be done about the situation with the Boeing 737 planes.
Right.
But fundamentally, one fact that no one disagrees about is sensors malfunctioned and humans could not override the effect of that malfunction. Mm-hmm. So the sensor, well-intended, well-designed, but when it failed, could not be overridden.
But that's a software issue, and that's a human issue.
It is impossible to know what kind of issue that is. Is it a user issue?
Okay.
Is it the designer of the software?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the failure of the actual physical sensor itself? Dan knows, and Dan is probably tired of hearing me, probably everyone in my life is tired of hearing me say this, but my best example is autonomously driving vehicles. They rely on all kinds of inputs and then all kinds of software and processing to create the ability for a car supposedly to drive without a human.
Right.
But what happens if the GPS fails or a sensor at a stoplight fails? Or what happens in the horrible event of someone crossing the street?
Well, you have, what am I trying to say here? You have.
You're not going to say I'm a bad driver.
No, you have written about this.
I have written about this, yes.
And the story is called Hit the Deer.
It is. Yes. I wondered, wow, you are a preparer. I grew up in the Midwest.
Okay.
Doesn't matter what any driving textbook, paper textbook at the time, doesn't matter what any driving textbook would tell you. Everyone driving down a road in rural Michigan is taught if a deer is in your path, suddenly hit the deer.
Because driving off into a ditch could kill you.
Driving off into a ditch is possibly a worse outcome.
And an autonomous car would not necessarily know to hit the deer as opposed to get out of the way.
Or would the software engineer who designed the algorithm be raised in the Midwest?
We're talking about artificial intelligence, and when we come back, I want to talk about how it's being used right now in the real world by business and industry and healthcare, et cetera, and what you should know about this as we go into this brave new world with Kathy Besson from Bank of America and Dan Schrag from Harvard. It's Charlotte Talks.
Hi, I'm Jermon Jackson.
And I'm Brian Martin.
Our podcast, Choose Our Own Adventure, is one of the five finalists in WFAE's Queen City PodQuest, the search for Charlotte's next great podcast.
Learn more about our podcast and find out who will win a podcast development deal with WFAE at the PodQuest Live finale, Saturday, May 4th at the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
Tickets and information at wfae.org/Queen City PodQuest.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about artificial intelligence because it's here, because it's being used, because you and the information you leave in little breadcrumbs around the world is being used. So the Bank of America is funding something called the Council on the Responsible Use of Artificial Intelligence because they are concerned that this thing could get out of hand eventually, and maybe already has in some cases. A big story about Facebook today and privacy issues. Kathy Bessant is here. She's the Chief Operations and Technology Officer of Bank of America, and she is the point person from the bank, I suppose, who led to the formation of this council and the funding of this council. Dan Schrag is the co-director of the Science, Technology, and Public Policy Program at the Belfer Center at Harvard University, and they and MIT are putting together the council. So, where is artificial intelligence being used right now? How would we, as people who don't think about this all the time, recognize it?
Well, any place that information and models applied to that information creates recommendations or outcomes or scenarios, artificial intelligence is being used. So, for example, very tangible examples. We use it at Bank of America to predict when we should refill ATMs so that they're always stocked with cash. We can look at traffic patterns, cash utilization, day of the month, day of the week, a multitude of other variables to make sure that every customer, every client who wants their cash can get it. Lots of examples in hiring. How do we assess with speed the likelihood that someone will be successful in our firm? So we look at a lot of data, we look at historical data, predictions about future data, put those models together so that we can supply the company with its most important asset, which is people, when we need them.
So you're actually already, and other companies too, are already using computers to help you decide who to hire?
We use computers to help understand not so much the hiring decision in our case, although okay. There are others that do that. For us to understand who we should talk to on a slate, on a hiring slate. So if someone comes to us with a French background, mm-hmm. what does that mean for the likelihood that they'll be successful in providing financial service advice to a customer?
How would a machine know that? How would a computer know that?
Historically, based on other people that we've hired in the past,
and because it can digest and interpolate more data than a human being can, and it can do it more quickly. It's more efficient to do it that way.
And that efficiency is required, right? Because today we have sites like LinkedIn and other hiring sites, so the candidate pool is exponentially larger than it's ever been. You know, we don't have to call people up anymore.
Right. And you mentioned that if you wanted to change the way you hire people, you don't use the way you've been hiring people all along. And the same is true, it seems, because you're talking about bias, built-in, unrecognized bias. If you want to change the world, you have to recognize your biases. The same is true, I would think, in a bank, of who deciding who gets a loan or at what interest rate that loan is going to be. Is that correct?
Well, the human decision-making is a key factor in those decisions, yes, today. And the use of data here should be helpful to the equality and to the trust and to the transparency of our use of data.
And part of the problem here, as I understand it, because you've said that the pace of change and the deployment of AI is happening at such a rate that it outstrips all of our infrastructure, social, human, legal frameworks, and workforce development. It's happening that fast. So nothing has caught up to what we're able to do technically.
I believe that to be true. It sounds high drama when I hear you say it, but it sounds completely plausible when I think it in my head. And I believe that to be true.
Well, let me ask you, Dan, because Kathy also says in some ways we're very far along in the development of AI, and in some ways we're at the beginning of a revolution. And she also says that cheap, high-speed computing power means technological change has now escalated to a pace rivaling the Industrial Revolution. This sounds big to me, and it sounds quick to me, although on the one hand we're at the beginning, on the other hand we're well down the road. Is she right about all of that?
I think she's right on both counts. In some ways, we really are just at the beginning, and I think there are a lot of fears of AI that are creating this kind of hysteria and actually are exactly why the kind of conversations we're having now within the Council for the Responsible Use of AI, but also around the country on this issue are so important. Because as new technologies come in and as things change, people need to feel comfortable with this. I mean, I think she's right. I think Kathy's exactly right about, in some ways, we're well into this, because this is not something that is based on some brand new discovery. This is part of the gradual transition to a more computerized society. Think back, 35 years ago, we didn't have ATMs and we had tellers and you had to go inside the bank to get cash. We used computers to essentially change that. And now few people actually go into a bank more than maybe a few times a year. That's a very different world. We did that without a whole lot of concern and a whole lot of panic. There may have been some within Bank of America, I don't know, but more or less that was a pretty smooth transition. In Massachusetts, we just got rid of the toll booth operators, and now we have cameras that take pictures of cars' license plates, and we take the pictures and send people bills for the tolls. All of that is done with computers, and people are pretty comfortable with that. They have no problem with that.
Except the toll operators.
Well, so there is a question of jobs that we should come back to. Yeah. And that's part of what I think Kathy was referring to with this sort of question of another industrial revolution. But I think the idea of computers making decisions for people, I think as long as they're trivial decisions, people are quite comfortable with it. They're really sort of saving us some of the grunt work and some of the mindless work that goes on. What's more interesting, though, is when computers start to make decisions that we think of as much more central to being human. A classic example that we discussed in our council meeting last November was the discussion of the ProPublica article about bias related to algorithms used for sentencing recommendations for judges. So there are AI algorithms that are developed that can essentially recommend to a judge what kind of bail a certain defendant should get based on the likelihood of that person showing up for trial, or recommend a sentence based on their likelihood to commit the same crime again or commit another crime. And what they discovered was that there was a big racial bias there. And that was a great concern to all people. It turns out, actually, on more analysis, that the algorithm itself wasn't wrong. The bias was in society, not in the computer. And what I mean by that is that, unfortunately, for a whole large number of social, economic, and deep historical reasons in this country, the rate of African American men going to jail is unbelievably high. One out of three African American men spend time in jail in their lifetime. It's a crazy statistic. But what that means is that the computer algorithms are picking up on that and perhaps correctly saying that indeed the likelihood of committing an additional offense is higher for African American men, and therefore it leads to this result that looks biased and racist on the outside, but it's actually reflecting a deeper bias in our society. Wow. And I think what's very important, though, is as we start allowing computers to assist with very important decisions like recommendations for sentencing, there needs to be, and this is the core issue that I think Kathy and I both agree on, there needs to be a human accountability in the system. Ultimately, humans need to understand and ask the question, is the computer coming up with the right answer? And ultimately, there has to be a human accountable in the system.
So there are many different levels to artificial intelligence and what it means to us and the impact of that intelligence. Let's begin with Clippy. Clippy was that little paper clip that Microsoft embedded in Word many years ago, and it would literally tap on your screen and say, "Can I help you with something?" And people hated Clippy, so they got rid of it. But now we have Siri, and we have Alexa, and the Bank of America has Erica. How are they different from Clippy?
Well, one thing is to access Erica, you've got to access
you've got to
Erica.
Welcome her into
you have
your
to
life.
Welcome her. In theory, you have to say to Alexa, Alexa,
uh-huh.
Right? So I do think
in theory,
I like that
term because I think Alexa is listening all the time. I think Jeff Bezos is sitting. There's a comic strip right now where he's listening all the time and actually interacts with you. He interferes with your life.
I mean, look, there's a separate issue which is really separate from AI, but it goes into the same level of concern about responsible use, which is just the question of our data-rich society. We live in a world now where collection and storage of data has gotten so cheap that Alexa can listen to you, and there are concerns that I don't like to have Alexa in my house because it's listening to me and is going to record everything I say. Now, that's not true, but...
How do you know?
Well...
How do you know that your cell phone isn't recording it? If you have an Android phone that Google isn't listening all the time?
Well, so those concerns about privacy, there are very real concerns about privacy, and the companies, Google, Amazon, et cetera, have been taken to task over privacy issues. And I think there are serious safeguards in place, but that is in some ways a separate discussion from the question of what you do with those data.
Yeah, the thing I would add there is to frame it up is I think the discussion is between what data and computers can do and what they should do, or the tension between the creators of artificial intelligence and the users of artificial intelligence, and I will be quite transparent. One of my goals with the council is to rebalance that debate from the creators of artificial intelligence to the users. Like Ash Carter at Harvard says very eloquently, it's one thing to have a computer predict where a missile should strike. It's another thing to make the decision to strike.
Your whole thrust here is in the title of what you've created, the Council on Responsible Use of Artificial Intelligence. Why are you at the Bank of America? Why are you concerned about that? It doesn't seem that Facebook doesn't seem to be concerned about this. They just fined Facebook $5 billion for privacy invasion using the data that we voluntarily give them. Why are you concerned? Whatever they were doing was not responsible use. So why are you concerned?
Well, first and foremost, we're in a completely different business. I say at a bank, you're in the trust business. So ensuring that our use of data and the algorithms that we create to make predictions, saying that use is insurably responsible, begins with our understanding that what people trust us with is brilliantly important. It is their personal data, and even more importantly, their money. And it's not just their money. It is their ability to retire when they want to, the ability of a company to create jobs, the ability of someone to fund a legacy for their children. So the stakes are extremely high for us, as they are in many other sectors. Healthcare comes to mind. And I believe fundamentally that if the users of artificial intelligence, and Bank of America believes, if the users of AI don't dominate more effectively in the debate, we will be the acceptors of what AI can do instead of the drivers of what AI can do.
How many other industries are involved in this council or are interested and in favor of what you're trying to do?
Dan, you go for this one.
Yep.
When we set this up, we intentionally, I mean, a lot of the discussions in this area, as Kathy sort of referred to, were being had by the technology companies, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Amazons, et cetera, the Microsofts, and then some people in academia. But really, we felt that there needed to be a much broader discussion because the question of what determines the responsible use of artificial intelligence is not up to the programmers. It's not up to the companies that just make the technology. It's up to all of the companies that are going to deploy the technology in contact with their customers. Because as Kathy said, it's that relationship that is the ultimately the critical thing. And these technologies are being used at that interface. In addition, it's really important to get a wide variety of academics in the room, not just computer scientists, but also ethicists, policy people, a variety of smart science and technology people, people who've thought about a wide range of issues. And then the other component of this council is people from policy, not just federal government, but also state government and local government, because they're making real decisions about not only how to use these technologies, but also to think about how to regulate this technology in terms of how other people use the technology.
Do you think most businesses who stand to make money from artificial intelligence, either by because they can use fewer employees and pay fewer benefits and have these artificial robot things running their business 24/7 with no vacation and no sick leave, how many of those companies are on board with this? How many of them are would likely to embrace this idea that you've come up with versus just letting this thing run whole hog on its own?
You know, I think the thing that was most significant to me about the first meeting of the council was that the notion that AI had to be leveraged and used and that it had to be used responsibly, there was no dispute about that. So regardless of the industry, regardless of the sector, I was blown away, literally, by the fact that we agreed responsibility was important. I think there's a lot of debate and discussion, which is why the council and Harvard's role in it as a unifier is so important, because no one interest in that the dynamic of how you get to responsible artificial intelligence, no one interest should dominate that debate.
We saw the use of bots in the last election and putting out fake news on social media accounts all over the world. And Dan, you say that in the next 10 years, due to artificial intelligence, we will be able to create a fake video of people, anybody, doing anything we want them to do in any environment we want them to be in. And it will be forensically impossible to distinguish that fake video from something that actually happened. When we come back, I want you to answer this question. How will we be able to function in such a world? And although there's an ethical question involved in that, how do you get people to be ethical about this if they can do something like that? We have to take a break. We're coming right back with more at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Kathy Vasant is with us, Chief Operations and Technology Officer for the Bank of America. Dan Schrag, Co-Director of Science, Technology, and Public Policy at the Belfer Center at Harvard University. Together, they have helped put together the Council on the Responsible Use of Artificial Intelligence. And that's the key. The key word there is responsible. And as you pointed out in something you wrote, Dan, that in 10 years we're going to be able to create these videos of anybody doing anything, anywhere, without any way to determine the veracity of what we're actually seeing with our own eyes. So in that, how can we function in a world like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I would just back off that a little bit just because I wasn't making a prediction.
But others have said that, that we're very close to that right now.
There's no question that our ability to doctor images and ultimately doctor videos is improving dramatically with the help of some of these technologies. And that's very troubling. That gets at some of the fundamental questions about how do we trust information in this complicated world. And, you know, these aren't new issues, right? This is just an extreme of something that already exists. We already live in a segmented world where people get information from their own trusted sources, and we are more and more separated in where people get information. And there's a lot of discussion and debate about what that means for our democracy. So the question then is, you know, what happens with information when you're able to essentially create fake information so easily?
Yeah.
It's one of the issues that I think our council needs to talk about in terms of, you know, how to think about how this technology can both be used and misused, because it is the misuse of the technology by a small number of people that can actually destroy all the benefits of the technology that are possible for everyone else.
Am I right in saying that one of the things that your council is going to be trying to do is to formulate rules on how this technology can and should be used? That the rules today really don't exist, which is why you're saying that the technology has outpaced other concerns. So if you come up with these rules, they're just rules. They're not laws. How do you make people follow them? Is there enforcement? Are there penalties? How do you do it?
Well, one of the points Dan made about the construct of the council is very important, which is that public policy officials, people in charge of things like laws and rules and regulations, have to be and are, in the case of the council, participating in the discussion. I do think having a framework, your word is rules. I geek out a little bit and say framework because people don't reject that so quickly. But principles. Yep. Well said, Dan. And I do think the importance of coming to agreement in a very democratic little d environment like the council is could add quite a bit to that discussion of public policy, laws, rules, and regs, and that's certainly one of our expectations.
So you're focusing, and we need to talk about this before we run out of time, you're focusing on four areas: privacy, rights, justice, and equality, transparency, and workforce. Let's begin with workforce, the fourth one, because that concerns human beings, a lot of human beings in some cases. This idea, grew out of the need for a bank strategy to deal with AI, but also from a worker's question about AI and other technologies and how it would change their jobs. Because we've already talked about how tellers are kind of a thing of the past. ATMs replaced them. Now I can deposit a check using my phone. I never have to go into a branch bank. Isn't one reason business is attracted to this new technology because you can replace low-level employees and who have to do repetitive tasks with something that can work 24/7, 365, and never takes a holiday?
That's one side of the discussion. The side of the discussion about efficiency, speed, better, faster, cheaper is, of course, a benefit to automation and to robotics and to AI. But part of the reason for the creation of the council and the creation of our thinking is we think that is irresponsible thinking, okay, to only focus in that direction. And our messaging around to our own workforce at Bank of America that we were going to transform what they do didn't resonate, because what we found statistically is that when workers hear the word transformation, they think, yeah, you're going to transform me right out of a job.
Okay.
So the discussion that I believe – and the real pure fact of it is we do not believe at Bank of America that artificial intelligence and robotics will reduce the number of workers. We believe it will change what they do. And if I have to summarize the strategy in four words, I can do it with high tech, high touch. The idea is to use tech, on repetitive routine things, mm-hmm, so that human interactions, in fact, can be more valuable, and to reskill our workforce so that they are prepared and able, not necessarily maybe to process a check manually or to fill an ATM, to my earlier example, manually, but they're ready for what is their role in that high value, mm-hmm, moment. And I am 100% convinced factually that reskilling and retraining can be done, and that it will be effective if it's focused on.
Theoretically, if artificial intelligence can start doing these repetitive tasks that, quite frankly, are probably boring to the people who have to do them now, would it make an employee's life actually better if they would embrace that and move on to some other new job that they've been trained for?
I believe that's the standard we have to hold ourselves to.
Okay.
The question is, again, is the technology used for the force of good, or as some have said, the force of workforce decimation? And I believe decimation should be unacceptable to us. The firm believes that.
Because Marshall Brain, I don't know if you know who he is. He's a professor, I think, at Wake Forest University. He's written a book, and he's been on this program. He's written a book called The End of Jobs. And he says he believes that robots, artificial intelligence, self-driving cars and trucks, computers will eliminate almost all work in the not too distant future, beginning with truck drivers because of autonomous driving vehicles. What's your take on that?
Can I jump in on this? Because yes. I think it's really important. First of all,
NC State, excuse me, Marshall Brains at NC State, excuse me. Go ahead.
So it's very easy to make, you know, send these shockwave comments like this into the ether. But I've got to say, this fear of machines taking over humans' jobs and doing away with work has been around since the mid-19th century. This is not a recent concern. Automation in factories, the assembly line and then ultimately robotics and now AI. And to some extent, it is happening. So historically, that's exactly what's happened. Machines have started to take away jobs from humans. But what happened was that new jobs were created because, in fact, capabilities were better, new types of services were available, and therefore new jobs were created. So from my perspective, this is really it is a legitimate concern and absolutely worthy of discussion. And we are going to be talking about it at our upcoming council meeting. Mm. Indeed, my colleague, Jason Furman, former head of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Obama, will be leading a discussion on this exact issue. But from my perspective, I think we need to just take a deep breath and realize this argument about machines taking away people's jobs has been around for a very long time. And every time it's happened, new jobs have been created in other places. Because, I think the key issue is what kind of training, what kind of responsibility do we as a society and do companies have to make sure that their workforce, the people that they've employed for many years, that their skills keep improving so they can actually keep up with the new technology and be eligible for the new jobs that are going to be created? Because the fact is, the jobs are going to be less sort of low-level jobs and more skilled jobs, and that's something we as a society have to think about.
The other thing I would add, and I agree with everything Dan just said, is that the discussion at the macro level, that this will be more jobs, just different jobs versus fewer jobs, that makes sense in the macro level. To the individual employee who processes that check today, that fear is real. Mm-hmm. And macro concepts like reskilling have to make sense at the employee level of one, and that's where the theoretical discussion has to meet the practical reality of how are we ensuring that our workforce reskilling is in advance of versus reactive to changes in technology.
So I think I can ask Bob's question. Bob has emailed us with a question. I think I can ask it of you, Kathy, because you're not yet the CEO. Might AI someday replace CEOs? I understand the AI train is out of the station. Is there any way for the impacts and benefits to be across the board, not just for the few at the top or affect those at the bottom?
Well, I hopefully never replace the CEO or any job that requires judgment, intellectual capital, real thought, strategy. Those things.
But isn't that the whole point of the evolution of artificial intelligence, to be able to make those decisions?
I think the benefit is to create the information that should be used in making decisions, not the decisions themselves. Again, it's the, yes, we can artificially, or we can use technology to determine where the missile might be likely to go. It's a different thing to interject the human judgment about how it will be used. And what I want artificial intelligence to do is to, and what I believe it can and should do, and my company believes it can and should do, is take away the repetitive tasks that Brian Moynihan has to produce every day. He's not writing spreadsheets by hand. He's right. Looking at reams of data and using it to make big-time decisions about liquidity and forecasting and how to make our company more effective, where to put the next branch or financial center. And he doesn't have to do those calculations. And freeing up that kind of brain power to make better decisions is exactly what I think the end state should be.
Okay. Eric emails on the
fact. Go ahead. Just jump in, because I think this is a perfect example of what we were talking about human accountability. The whole point is that I think we all agreed at our council meeting in November that while these technologies may actually in some ways do better than humans because they don't necessarily have the biases or the errors that humans have. Ultimately, human accountability in the system is critical. That doesn't necessarily mean humans making every decision along the way, but there has to be human accountability. And to me, for a company, at least in my naive view as an academic, the CEO is the ultimate sign of human accountability in a company. Ultimately, the buck stops with him or her.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because Nakisa on Facebook says, are we talking about the biases that the humans that are creating the technology that will also go into the technology, too? In other words, she's saying, won't the technology, won't the algorithms be biased because people who are writing them are biased? And one of the things that you are concerned about is rights, justice, and equality. And you're asking questions like how to conceive of human rights online and whose responsibility it is to ensure that algorithms respect those rights. So talk about that. How do we eliminate the biases from the software writers?
Well, one thing, and Nikisa's question is spot on. So it's at the basis of why we support the council so aggressively. There's no question, nothing makes me crazier than when someone says AI is better than humans. It is, in fact, a subset of humans that can make humans better and their decision-making better and should. So, and the one thing that AI does indisputably is create transparency to decision-making so that biases can be seen. Right now, if I'm biased, it's all inside my brain or my heart, and nobody can see it. What they see is my decision.
Right.
If it's written in a model and can be tested, then those biases have a much better shot at being eliminated because they can be seen. That's the way I frame it up.
Okay. Eric emails, I'm a fellow Bank of America associate and wonder how industry can stay compliant from a data use transparency perspective and continue to develop and protect our proprietary data models. In other words, how can we stay compliant without giving up our AI secret sauce if we have to be data use transparent? This gets to privacy issues, and I thought privacy issues were just going to be concerning individuals and customers, but it also affects the companies involved in all of this.
Well, I'm proud of Eric's question, so well done. I hope you work for me. To me, the issue here is, again, transparency into those models. And we work in banking in a highly regulated industry, so whether they're created by pencil calculations or by sophisticated computing, we have had to be regulatorily responsible for the output of our models since the sands of time. So I like to believe that that actually done well, responsible artificial intelligence produces better compliance and allows us, if we govern effectively inside all of our firms as we deploy it, we can ensure equality and justice as opposed to walk away from it. So, Eric, I don't know if I got to the heart of your question, but that's how I think about it in my head.
What do you do with privacy concerns? You have all these people voluntarily giving data or having to give it up in order for your apps, your website to function properly. How do you protect their privacy?
Well, we've been regulated from a privacy perspective for decades in financial services. Okay. So we're not new to this. And we protect it by how we create the data, how we store it, how we transport it, and how we govern its use.
We only have a minute left, but the Council on Responsible Use of Artificial Intelligence, which is your organization that you helped spearhead and that Dan helped spearhead as well. Dan, you say, Dan, that the technology is changing so quickly that the solutions your council comes up with cannot be static. You say this needs to be ongoing. So how will new developments in technology change the solutions you're finding to today's challenges? How often do you have to rehash this?
Well, I think the idea of the council is to actually start the conversation dealing with the issues that are confronting people today, but with the realization that the issues that confront us 5 years from now or 3 years from now might actually be different. New issues will come up.
Yeah.
And having a group that's comfortable, that's used to interacting across the policy sector, the corporate sector, and the academic sector, I think that's really important.
Let me stop you there. Dan Schrag, co-director of the Belfer Center at Harvard University. Kathy Bessant, Chief Operations and Technology Officer at the Bank of America. Together, the Council on the Responsible Use of Artificial Intelligence. Thanks for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.